Good morning. It's 7:41 on January 27th, 2012. Good morning. And I've been spoiled by walking in 40-degree, 50-degree weather. It's 28 this morning, maybe 30. It's cold. Yeehaw. My nose is running. The wind is whipping this morning. I'm bundled into the hood, so if anything, the voice will sound a little bit muffled, but we shouldn't get a lot of wind artifact on the microphone this morning. I'm trying to get the walk in before I get in the car and drive south. From here to Colorado Springs is ostensibly 2 hours, but because it's right through Denver, the reality is much closer to 3. Now, I might take the 470 bypass and loop out around the city, pay the toll, I don't know. Let's see. See what I feel like when I get there. There's something about the open road and riding that frees my mind much the way that walking does. And so perhaps what I'll do is just bite the bullet, take the time, and leave early enough. The programming is up for Cosine. Those of you who are in the Colorado Springs area, there's going to be some from the select group that listens to this podcast, but you never know. Anyway, I've got a program this afternoon at 5, and I will be on the quiz show at 9. Then I've got like 5 tomorrow, and 1 on Sunday, which should be interesting. Connie Willis is going to moderate that panel. As far as I know, that's the only panel I'm going to share with her, although it could be that she's on the quiz show tonight. I don't know. I didn't see who else is going to participate in that. So I'm looking forward to the ride. I'm looking forward to the weekend. I'm looking forward to a break from this normal. What that means in terms of the podcast, as I've said before, I have no idea. Perhaps I will manage to get a walk in, and maybe I won't. A lot's going to depend on how late I stay up, how early I get up, what the situation is on the ground there. The hotel itself is just off an exit of the interstate, which makes me think that perhaps walking anywhere may be somewhat problematic. If that's the case, then I'm not going to do something silly like walk in a circle around the hotel or anything. Probably. Now, anything's possible. That could happen. It's just not likely. What's more likely is that I'll fall into my old habit of skipping rather than walking and talking. If that happens, I apologize in advance, but don't be too surprised if that's where it goes. Somewhere in there, I'm supposed to be teaching a class. I'm going to tell my class I'm going on a road trip and let it go with that. I'll be back Sunday afternoon. It'll be early evening my time. And then the next regular walk time will be Monday morning. Monday's going to be a big day because I'm going to be going to the high school and meeting with creative writing teachers there. There are 2 of them. And I hope what we're going to come out of that with is, one, a little added spur to me to get my act together and write, and 2, the opportunity to work with some kids to help them fine-tune their writing skills. One of the interesting challenges, I think, is going to be how do we get kids who really haven't done anything yet, they have limited life experience, how do we get them to write meaningful things? And I think the key to that is to get them to write things that mean something to them. The challenge, and I saw it in elder daughters' writing as well, is that they want to write about ideas that they haven't really formed yet, which is really in itself a good way to find out how what you think about those ideas. I do that a lot myself. But there needs to be some grounding. There needs to be some reality. And for most kids, and I was the same way, which is why I'm so tuned into this at the moment. You know, it was clueless. Clueless. So interesting challenges there. There's a lot of stuff that kids go through that would make rich fodder. My younger daughter has tapped into that already. At 13, she's writing some amazingly nuanced material, some wonderfully rich content that rings as clear as a bell. A hackneyed phrase, terrible cliche, but it does ring. It does have that feel. She and I were talking about, speaking of writing, she and I were talking about The Foundry, the music that I talked about yesterday, on the way to school. When I took her to school yesterday morning, we were talking about The Foundry and how she'd been listening to it on loop as well, and trying to figure out what the story was in that music, because the music itself was so inspiring. It was so wonderful. I think we're going to be able to buy a CD of it. I think we're going to be able to get a copy of a recording, and I'm hoping that the recording is going to be relatively high quality. Now, they do recording in the Civic Center all the time and sell the CDs, so I'm hoping that we're not going to get a lot of room noise and echo. We shouldn't get a lot because the audience was spellbound from the very first clank on that saw on that music. So I'm really looking forward to it. We will have to get a copy. I do need to get a hold of John Mackey and find out if I can license that book, I think. That work for a book. What I need to do is listen to it and write whatever it is that the music is telling me. And then contact Mackey with, this is what I want to do. This is the book I wanted to go with. How much will it cost? He makes this work, this music, available for free to bands, high school bands, college bands, so that they can play the music in competition. He writes a lot of work for high school band, and apparently is rather an interesting person in his own right. He's got a blog that I think is called OstiMusic, OstiMusic.com. I'm not sure that. If you search OstiMusic, you'll find him anyway. And he talks about things like changing a single chord progression, changing a single note at some point in the work that takes the work from being mundane to sublime. From being, yeah, okay, to wow. And it's interesting that he sees one note as being significant to the effort. And that's an interesting idea, an interesting notion. Now, I'm not much of a wordsmith. I pick the word that seems right at the time, and I don't second guess those word choices very often. Once in a great while, I'll go back. But part of the joy, part of the benefit of working in the longer form is that I can focus on story and not on word. That for a lot of people, that's a stupid statement. For a lot of writers, that's an idiotic thing to say. Because, of course, the words you choose tell your story. The reality, the truth, I go back to storytelling in its purest. I go back to storytelling around a campfire. I go back to what we used to do when we told stories to each other. Back around a pot-bellied stove in New England with the pickle barrel on one side and the cracker barrel on the other. And the wind and the cold and the snow outside. And what did we tell each other, and how did we tell stories? When we'd heard all of the stories, how did we tell new ones? What did we tell? And I think a lot of what we did was tell stories in different ways, tell stories with different words, and use the audience as a kind of amplifier to pick up those things that resonate with that audience, and as a kind of compressor to, or a limiter to suppress those things that don't resonate. And the only way we do that is by reading the audience as we're in the process of telling a story. The best example in modern times I can think of would be the comedian. Now, comedians spend a lot of time trying to find exactly the right words and exactly the right timing and exactly the right phrasing. But the reality is, if they followed those mechanical preset modes, then they miss the opportunity to expand the audience. They miss the opportunity to reach out and grab that particular audience. I know when I write, the things that resonate, the things that people write back to me about, are not necessarily the things that I thought that they would write about. Now, yeah, the end of chapter, the end of owner share, many people have written to me about that. And I hope they continue to write to me about that. I hope it continues to come to them and say, what the hell were you thinking? And the answer was, of course, what I'm thinking is about the story. And what has to happen to make this a story? What has to happen to hook the reader, to engage the reader, to not leave the reader with a nice tied-up bow ending where they can walk away, where they can ignore what's going on, where they can take what they've read and forget it. But it's an opportunity for me to hook the reader in a way that they can't forget it, that they can't walk away, that there's something here that's bigger than just a story. Bad things happen to good people all the time. But until it happens to you, until it happens in your life, it's all, oh yeah, well, bad things happen to good people all the time. But when it happens to you, then it's real. Then it's almost surreal, because it's you. And all of that hypothesized distance that you think is going to happen because bad things happen to people all the time, so, you know, of course I'm going to be able to cope with it. Yeah, uh-huh. No, not really. I'm conversing at the moment with a guy in Sweden who was very upset with me for the ending. And I pointed out to him that, you know, the ending is only the ending of the Traitor's Tales. It's not the ending of Ishmael Hoang. It's not the ending of his story. No story has to end. The only ending is death. Life is the only journey with a terminal destination. You know, I'm going to Colorado Springs this afternoon. Yeah, I'm going to Colorado Springs to start something else this afternoon. And then I'm going to come back home and start something new when I come back. And the only journey with a final destination is life, which is really why the themes through all the books. And nobody should really be surprised that I should end the story the way I did. And I should end the series the way I did. In part, I think it was Memoir or somebody, pointed out that the book started with the death of a very important woman in his life, his mother, although it happened off stage. And it ended with the senseless death of a very important woman in his life. And everything that happened in between was governed by women. Everything that happened in between was really his reaction to what was being done and to what was happening to him. Everything that was happened in the middle was completely out of his control. Now, I didn't actually realize that when I was writing it, but it's exactly correct. And if I had intended to do it, I probably couldn't have done it any better, because that's really an important idea. That's really an important issue for a lot of people, and I include myself in this. I think that there's a part of your life where everything happens to you, where your actions are really reactions to the things that happen to you and around you. And I don't think you can ever get away from the fact that you're going to respond to the things that happen to you and around you. But at some point, I think every adult human says, all right, enough. This is my life. It's going to be, some part of it is going to be mine. So even if I can't have it all, some of the decisions I'm going to make are going to be, from one perspective, selfish, but from another perspective, self-asserting. And I think that's part of growing up. I think that's part of the arc of maturity. I think that's something that we do. We gain empathy as we get older. We gain sympathy as we get older. And there's a point where we have to separate empathy and sympathy from self and say, I have my own life to live. I am permitted to be empathetic to my own needs, to be sympathetic to what I need and want. And in a lot of ways, I mean, writing for me is that thing. I can't control everything that happens. I can't control the fact that we had kids. I can't control the fact that my wife gets sick a lot. I can't do a lot about an awful lot of stuff. I can be sympathetic to the situation. I can be sympathetic to my wife constantly being ill. The poor woman spends about one day a year feeling good, and then the rest of the year is varying shades of miserableness. But I can control this part, this creative urge. I need to control it better because I need to do more of it. That's also part of it. But I think this idea that we go through a large portion of our lives in reaction mode, even when we think we're being proactive, even when we think we're being active, that we've taken control of our lives, we know who we are, that's bullshit. It's something that's going to show up more in Tana's work too, I think, as she goes through this second book. Wow, it's windy. I think it's snowing. Every once in a while I get a spot of snow, something on my face. I've seen little snow pellets on the sidewalk in places as I've made my hike. Damn, that wind is sharp. Anyway, kind of deep for before breakfast, I suppose, but so it goes. It's interesting, there's these bands of really dark black clouds. And then there's open sky, it's clear blue. It's a beautiful morning, clear blue sky. And then these amorphous black cloud shapes snaking across the sky. There's a lot of them off to the northeast. There's not so much off to the west. I hope that means that this storm is breaking up, that it's a front that's moving through and moving out, not a front that's moving in and means I have to drive through bad weather. Fingers crossed on that one. So anyway, crossing the street, hoping I don't get hit. The problem with having my hood up and snugged down is that my peripheral vision is miserable. I can't really see what's going on around me without twisting my whole upper body. Here I am. I'm at the back gate. tomorrow is another day. And I hope I'll talk to you then. If not, soon.